head of Harvard Hillel, talking about the weaponization of anti-Semitism as a way to suppress dissent over what Israel is doing in Gaza right now, Professor Muhammad.
Well, I think that his comments and his testimony in the op-ed that he wrote from his vantage point speaks very clearly to the absence of a balanced discussion about Claudine Gay's testimony, as was true of the two other presidents, Liz McGill and Kornbluth. The truth is that they all performed as they should have. They spoke clearly and directly to personally condemning expressions of anti-Semitism, of which intifada, by definition, is not necessarily, which we could talk about more. But putting that aside, they were following the instructions of general counsel and likely the board chairs of their various universities. In the case of Claudine Gay, for example, you can see Alan Garber, who is now the current president, the interim president, sitting behind her in glasses and a beard, almost mouthing her responses. Because as second in charge of the university, they were both prepared to explain the current policies that deal with hate speech and academic freedom. And so what Mr. Steinberg is talking about is the context in which that entire hearing was a setup where there was no correct answer to a lawful question, a legal question about whether or not certain forms of speech violate the code of conduct. It always depends. And the weaponization of Jews in this case, as he described in his op-ed, suggested to me in watching that hearing for 5 hours and 40 minutes that people like Virginia Fox had no intention of extending protections to Jews at Harvard or anywhere else. This was a setup to take down DEI and anti-racism and all of the other things that the right has been going after, because that's what she said when she opened the hearing. She described the hearing as a case of people like me teaching classes, which she identified in her opening remarks as the real problem, as a prime example of anti-racism and critical race theory creating institutional anti-Semitism. That's a lie. It's a form of fascist propaganda. I actually teach about anti-Semitism in that class. And so what Mr. Steinberg is describing is exactly what is happening here. Jews have been used as a wedge for the right to take down all the entire edifice that has been put in place to deal with structural racism in this society.
Do you feel a chill at the Kennedy School? What about other African-American professors? Your response to Christopher Rufo cheering the resignation of Gay, writing the word scalped.
Well, listen, I mean, you know, speaking of history, in order to even understand that reference, one would have to understand the war against indigenous people, the genocide committed against them, and forms of settler colonialism that birthed this country. This is an evocation of that history in Christopher Rufo, who is leading the charge against people like me, against Claudine Gay, against everyone who works in a university who believes in truth and justice and a future that is better than our past. I mean, it's not an accident that in the same news week that ultimately brings us the resignation of Claudine Gay, Nikki Haley was on tape being a slavery denier. I mean, this is the debate we're having in this country about whether you can actually be honest about the country in all of its complexity. No one is saying that is the whole story, that all the terrible things that happened in the past are the only thing that matters. But the truth is that in half the states, let me repeat, you can't teach that. And the way things are going now, you won't be able to teach it at private universities either.
I want to talk about teaching and what we understand about history and switch to connected but different subject. Professor Khalil Gibran Muhammad, I want to ask you about the presidential race right now. On the campaign trail last week, Republican presidential hopeful Nikki Haley made headlines after she did not cite slavery when asked what she believed caused the U.S. Civil War. She was fielding a question from a participant in a town hall meeting in Berlin, New Hampshire.
What was the cause of the United States Civil War? Well, don't come with an easy question or anything. I mean, I think the cause of the Civil War was basically how government was going to run, the freedoms and what people could and couldn't do. What do you think the cause of the Civil War was? I'm sorry?
I'm not running for president. I wanted to see
yours. A good thing.
On the cause of the Civil War.
I mean, I think it always comes down to the role of government and what the rights of the people are. And I will always stand by the fact that I think government was intended to secure the rights and freedoms of the people. It was never meant to be all things to all people. Government doesn't need to tell you how to live your life. They don't need to tell you what you can and can't do. They don't need to be a part of your life. They need to make sure that you have freedom. We need to have capitalism. We need to have economic freedom. We need to make sure that we do all things so that individuals have the liberties so that they can have freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom to do or be anything they want to be without government getting in the way.
And in the year 2023, it's astonishing to me that you answer that question without mentioning the word slavery.
What do you want me to say about slavery?
No, you've answered my question. Thank you.
Next question.
So that's Republican presidential candidate Nikki Haley. And again, let's remember, she's the former governor of South Carolina. Facing backlash over a comment, she later said, quote, of course, the Civil War was about slavery. We know that. That's the easy part of it. Professor Khalil Gibran Muhammad, you're a professor of history, race and public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School, author of The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime and the Making of Modern Urban America. It was described as a real gaffe on her part that she misspoke. But explain exactly what she was voicing. This was not unusual to hear in a certain sector of U.S. society.
It was not a gaffe. Let's be clear about that. Nikki Haley has consistently denied the relevance of the history of racism in this country and the present of racism in this country. Nikki Haley running in a party who is led by a man known for serial discrimination against people of color, as well as harboring actual neo-Nazis, both within his larger political close circle, but also defending people, as was true in August of 2017 on the campus of the University of Virginia, chanting, "Jews will not replace us," and essentially giving them a pass as good people. This is the party. This is the Republican Party, the very party that led the witch hunt trial, or should I say hearing, that took place on December 5th. And so when you put it all together, the serial denial of slavery, let's be clear, the serial denial of slavery that is absolutely responsible for how this country came to be an economic juggernaut in the 19th century because of cotton exports, which is not a secret. It is a simple fact. That was not just a Southern problem. It was embedded in both Northern institutions, in the financial sector, as well as in the larger European context. So to deny slavery in 2024, to essentially say, wink, wink, nod, nod, it's not that important, let's move on, is precisely the mirror inverse of what Claudine Gay and those other presidents were being accused of somehow denying the saliency of anti-Semitism. But that actually isn't true. This is why fascism is such a threat in this moment, because it does not depend on facts. It is only about misinformation and propaganda and catering to people's fears. And in this case, Nikki Haley is trying to compete for it. Ron DeSantis has already proven himself to have fascist tendencies, if not fascist plans, just like Trump announcing that he plans to be a dictator, at least for the first day he's in office. Trump, by the way, was mentioned in the hearing as someone who the questioners asked the presidents if they would be willing to invite to campus to prove their commitment to academic freedom. All of them said yes, of course, but this is the absurdity of the stakes of what we're talking about. People who actually harbor neo-Nazis, people who actually deny slavery, are leading a campaign so that people like me don't get to teach the history of slavery, and presidents like Claudine Gay and Liz McGill and others don't get to lead institutions that will be better than they have been for most of their histories.
Khalil Gibran Muhammad, I want to thank you for being with us, professor of history, race, and public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School, author of The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America. When we come back, the United Nations is urging all parties in the Middle East to show restraint after a suspected Israeli drone strike killed a top Hamas official inside Lebanon, raising the risk of a regional war. We'll speak with the Dutch Palestinian analyst Muin Rabbani. Stay with us. Homeland by the Lebanese oud player Hossam Hayek. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Fears of a regional war in the Middle East are growing after a top Hamas official was assassinated in a Beirut, Lebanon suburb Tuesday. Hamas's deputy leader, Salah al-Aruri, was killed in a suspected Israeli drone strike that also killed, it's believed, six other Hamas members. Al-Aruri was the chief of Hamas's operations in the occupied West Bank, also credited with strengthening ties between Hamas and the Lebanese group Hezbollah. While Israel has not claimed responsibility for the assassination, one prominent Israeli lawmaker congratulated the Mossad and Shin Bet on social media. An Israeli army spokesperson said the military is in a, quote, very high state of readiness in all arenas, in defense and offense, unquote. At the United Nations, a spokesperson for the UN Secretary General urged nations to show restraint.
Because of the escalating tensions and the fragility of the situation in the region, we are calling for maximum restraint from all parties. We don't want any rash actions that could trigger further violence.
Lebanon's Prime Minister Najib Mikati condemned the drone strike, warning the attack, quote, aims to draw Lebanon into a new phase of confrontations, unquote. The assassination came a day before the fourth anniversary of the U.S. assassination of the Iranian general Qasem Soleimani, who was killed by a U.S. drone strike inside Iraq under the Trump administration, January 3, 2020. Earlier today, at least 73 people were killed in a pair of bomb blasts in Iran near Soleimani's tomb during an event marking his death. 173 at least were injured in the blasts, which local officials describe as a terrorist act. We're joined right now by Muin Rabbani. He is Middle East analyst, co-editor of Jedalia, and host of the Connections podcast. He was previously a senior analyst for the International Crisis Group. His latest piece for Mondo Weiss is headlined, "The Long History of Zionist Proposals to Ethnically Cleanse the Gaza Strip." We're going to begin with what's happened in Lebanon and the significance of it. Thanks so much for being with us, Muin Rabbani.
Good to be with you.
So if you can talk about the assassination of the Hamas leader and what exactly this means, who al-Aruri was.
Well, Salah al-Aruri was a West Bank founder of the military wing of Hamas, the Qassam, the Azadil Qassam brigades. He spent many years in Israeli prisons and was then deported. Most recently was living in Beirut, in the southern suburbs of Beirut, effectively under Hezbollah protection. He was a key liaison between Hamas and Hezbollah in Lebanon, and also with the Iranian government. He's said to have been close with Yahya Sinwar and Mohammed Dif, respectively, the political and military leaders of Hamas in the Gaza Strip, and the architects of the Hamas attacks of October 7th. So I think this assassination is significant in two respects. First of all, that Israel has managed to assassinate a senior leader of Hamas and measured against their failure to really achieve anything of military significance in the Gaza Strip over the course of the last 3 months. This can be considered a significant achievement for them, although I think its impact on Hamas as an organization, apart from a serious blow to their morale, I don't think there will be much consequence. The second, and perhaps more important, is that Hezbollah has clearly identified any such act by Israel on Lebanese territory, and particularly in the capital, Beirut, as a red line to which Hezbollah will respond with a significant escalation. And although Hezbollah is known to be very strategic in its actions and not to be impulsive in its reactions, I think a response is inevitable. And the question people are asking now is whether it will respond in a way that maintains the kind of controlled escalatory ladder between Hezbollah and Israel, or whether Israel's assassination has now set in motion a process that will lead to full-scale war, not only between Israel and Lebanon, but perhaps also a wider regional conflict.
Do you know about the others who were killed in this attack?
Well, seven people in all were assassinated yesterday. In addition to Aruri, there were two commanders of the Qassam Brigades, the Hamas military wing, in addition to four other Hamas cadres. It's quite clear that Aruri was the key target. And I think one thing that requires explanation from Hamas's side is how these seven people were meeting in a Hamas office in Beirut at a time when it was very clear that Aruri was wanted, not only by Israel, but also by the United States, which approximately a decade ago put a price on his head, and why they didn't take greater precautions in terms of operational security that allowed Israel to book this achievement. And some are even, you know, describing it as a known goal by Hamas at a time when it is denying Israel any significant military achievements in the Gaza Strip.
So what does this mean for a wider regional, perhaps, war? I mean, you have, I think, privately, the U.S. has been reaching out to leadership in Lebanon. This then takes place, not clear what the U.S. knowledge of this was. You have, at the time of this broadcast, Hassan Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, has not yet spoken, but he's expected to give a major address. The significance of this attack on the killing of the Hamas, some of the Hamas leadership.
Well, I think what many analysts in the region are concluding is that Israel clearly would like to see greater regional escalation, and that a key reason it would like to see this escalation is because it knows that it will enjoy the support and eventually perhaps the participation of the United States in that escalation. To be clear, Washington has indicated to Israel that one of its main priorities is to prevent precisely the kind of regional escalation that we may now be about to witness. But Israel, I think, also understands that although it is acting in contradiction to U.S. policy preferences, that it can essentially do as it pleases because, apart from a potential verbal slap on the wrist, there will be no consequences from either the United States or from key European governments. And so, therefore, it can continue on this path. And you mentioned the terrorist attack in Kerman in Iran today, near the grave of Qasem Soleimani, the head of the Quds Force, who was assassinated by the United States. And I think ultimately, I think Israel's ideal situation would be one in which it is able to draw the United States into a direct confrontation with Iran. I don't think it's a likely scenario at this point, but it's one that's becoming increasingly plausible as we see intensified genocide, not only in Gaza, but also these kinds of greater escalations in Lebanon, in the Red Sea, in Yemen, and in Iraq, in Syria, and now potentially elsewhere as well. So I think a regional war is very much on the cards. It's by no means a certainty, but I do think the confidence Israel has that it can do as it pleases and not suffer any consequences for any of its actions is the key variable here.
Muin Rabbani, I want to ask you about your new piece from Mondo Weiss, headlined "The Long History of Zionist Proposals to Ethnically Cleanse the Gaza Strip." Israeli news outlets report that the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu reportedly told a group of Israeli lawmakers last week, quote, "Regarding voluntary immigration, this is the direction we're going in," Netanyahu said. Israel's Minister of National Security, the man who's been convicted of terrorism, Itamar Ben-Gvir, has made similar comments.
The solution of encouraging the residents of Gaza to emigrate is one that we must advance. It's the right, just, moral, and human solution. I call on the Prime Minister and the new Foreign Minister, who I congratulate on his appointment. Now is the time to coordinate an emigration project, a project to encourage the residents of Gaza to emigrate to countries of the world. Let's be clear, we have partners around the world whose help we can use. There are people around the world with whom we can advance this idea. Encouraging their immigration will allow us to bring home the residents of the communities near the Gaza border and the residents of the Gush Katif settlements.
Those were the words of Israel's Minister of National Security, Itamar Ben-Gvir. On Tuesday, the U.S. State Department issued a statement rejecting Ben-Gvir's comment, as well as those made by Bezalel Smotrich. Meanwhile, the Times of London reports Israeli officials have held secret talks with the Democratic Republic of the Congo and several other countries to take in Palestinians from Gaza. If you can talk about the history of this, Muin, and also talk about when they refer to voluntary migration in Gaza, and also talk about Egypt and the pressure that's being brought to bear on Egypt to open its borders to the Palestinians of Gaza.
Yes, and voluntary emigration is now, referencing that article you mentioned, being marketed as humanitarian emigration. In other words, we're doing these people a favor by ethnically cleansing them. I think the problem here is that many people associate the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians with the Israeli extreme right, with people like Ben-Gvir, Smotrich, Netanyahu, and so on. But the point I was seeking to make in that article, which is actually a lengthy Twitter thread that I then posted on Mondo Weiss, is that ethnic cleansing, or what Zionists would call transfer, is intrinsic to Zionist and later Israeli policy towards the Palestinians from the very outset. So as early as 1895, Theodor Herzl, the founder of the contemporary political Zionist movement, wrote that we need to spirit the penniless population across the borders and find employment for it in other lands. If you go to the period between the British Mandate and the foundation of the State of Israel in 1948, you find that the Zionist movement set up a transfer committee with very clear terms of reference to ensure that refugees who were expelled would not be able to return to Palestine to destroy their villages and things of that sort. And the Gaza Strip, in fact, with a population that consists of more than three quarters of Palestinian refugees who were ethnically cleansed in 1948, has since the 1950s been a key target for depopulation by Israel, because it doesn't want all these refugees living within sight, so to speak, of their former homes on its borders. And it has produced a number of proposals and initiatives over the years to achieve that goal, including even one in the late 1960s, to send over some 60,000 Palestinians from the Gaza Strip to Paraguay, in return for which the Mossad would discover that it no longer had the resources to hunt Nazi fugitives being sheltered by the Stroessner regime. So my point was really to demonstrate that this is not a recent policy proposal by the extreme fringes of the Israeli political spectrum, but has been intrinsic to mainstream Zionism and later Israeli policy from the very outset.
You say at the end of your piece, Moin Rabbani, as importantly, the 1948 Nakba did not defeat the Palestinians who initiated their struggle from the camps of exile, those in the Gaza Strip most prominently among them. It would take a Blinken level of foolishness to assume the expulsion of Palestinians from the Gaza Strip would produce a different outcome. Talk about Netanyahu's goal to de-Hamasify Gaza, and what exactly that means, and the effect of the killing at this point of over 22,000 Palestinians.
Yes, well, that takes me back to the second part of your previous question, which I had neglected to answer, which is that at the outset of the current war, Israel saw that it had unqualified, unconditional Western support from its U.S. and European sponsors, and resurrected this long-standing ambition to cleanse the Gaza Strip of Palestinians. And the proposal that was put front and center, literally on October 7th and onwards, was to move the population of the Gaza Strip to the Sinai Desert, to Egypt. And this was an idea that was very enthusiastically embraced by the U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken. And on his first trip to the region, he actually sought to market this to Washington's Arab allies. And I think, you know, he is somewhat of a clueless airhead when it comes to the Middle East. And I think he was expecting to hear from U.S. allies, Arab allies, you know, how can we help you help our Israeli friends? And instead, he was met with categorical refusal and rejection for this proposal, first and foremost by Egypt. And the U.S. and European governments later came out with a position that they would oppose forced displacement from the Gaza Strip, leaving open the possibility of what we're seeing now, an Israeli military campaign, a primary objective of which is to make the Gaza Strip unfit for human habitation, and then the encouragement of voluntary, or what is now even being called humanitarian emigration in order to achieve the ethnic cleansing. And I think the genocide that we're now seeing in the Gaza Strip, and this is something, of course, that's going to be adjudicated by the International Court of Justice in The Hague after South Africa recently made an application under the Genocide Convention. You know, all these things put together, making the Gaza Strip unfit for human habitation.
Moin Rabbani, we're going to have to leave it there. I thank you so much for being with us. Middle East analyst, co-editor of Jadalia. We'll link to your piece, The Long History of Zionist Proposals to Ethnically Cleanse the Gaza Strip. Happy belated birthday to Dennis McCormick. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
A Renaissance Coffee is open at SFU. Parminder and his team have been serving the SFU community with great coffee for more than 20 years. If you're looking for a wholesome meal, delectable desserts, or something to warm yourself and lift your spirits, Renaissance Cafe is a place to be, featuring fair trade espresso beverages and brewed coffee. Renaissance Coffee is open Monday to Friday from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. Well, how do you get up and go?